This episode of She Explores is sponsored by Columbia Sportswear and their OutDry Extreme technology. It's used in shells, jackets, pants, and boots to keep you dry and ventilated. Stay tuned for later in the episode to learn more about how it works. Stay dry and comfortable no matter what. Learn more by visiting Columbia.com. I'm Gail Straub, and you're listening to She Explores. Before we get started here, I just want to let you know about a live recording of She Explores that'll take place in Portland, Oregon on April 19th at Columbia headquarters. I'll interview Mary L. Cowden of Oregon Wild, and we'll be inviting you, the guests, on stage to share their funny stories from the trail. Learn more about it via the link in the episode landing page or on the show notes. I'd love to meet some listeners in person. Public speaking isn't my favorite thing in the world, but it's a lot easier with listeners like you. Now, on with the show.
Sarah is always all in. She's all in with family, she's all in with friends, she's all in with work, and if you've ever seen her on a dance floor, you know she doesn't understand how to give less than 100%. She's the one you want as your sister, your daughter, your partner, because she is so dedicated and loyal to the people and causes she cares about. These traits are also what make her such a beautiful filmmaker.
Today's episode is about going all in for your loves. I first met Sarah Menzies 2 months ago in Marfa, Texas. You might remember her voice from episode 58, Are You Allowed to Change Your Dream?
I mean, yeah, I want to be a good person. I want to make the people around me feel good. I want my loving partner to feel supported and loved. And I want to make sure my dog gets outside enough times in the day to be happy.
Sarah is a documentary filmmaker. She's made character-driven films for brands like Patagonia and REI. You might recognize her from her two most recent, The Murnervator and Stillhead Quest. Both feature women that break the stereotype of what you typically expect to see in outdoor media. The Murnervator profiles Myrna Valerio, a plus-size ultra runner. Stillhead Quest features Terry Myers, a grandmother and a fly fisherwoman. And on April 29th, Sarah's first feature-length documentary, Afghan Cycles, will make its debut at Hot Docs Film Festival in Toronto. Outside Online recently wrote an article about her entitled, quote, Sarah Menzies Knows the World's Coolest Women. Sarah finds and profiles these women because she's passionate about uplifting stories that aren't told as often, and she really cares about her subjects. It's a bit embarrassing to admit, but when I first met Sarah, I felt special. I was comfortable right away, and that's not usually the case for me. I was making dumb jokes. I thought, how rare is it that we meet an instant friend these days? Well, the more I've gotten to know her, I've learned that it isn't quite as rare for Sarah. And yet, it didn't make me feel any less special. It just made Sarah more special, if that makes sense. The voice you heard at the beginning of the episode is Caitlin Bailey, Sarah's girlfriend. You're going to hear her throughout the episode because she knows Sarah's dedication to her craft intimately. Think of her as the supporting character. Because when we talk about going all in for your loves, I don't think we should think about it as jumping in and letting the current take us downriver. Sarah's story is about what she would do for her many loves, and in turn, what they would do for her. Let's go way back and get to know Sarah.
I was a tomboy when I was a kid, big time. Scratched up knees, playing basketball. Like, I was definitely a little tomboy. I have a brother and a sister. I was always really close with them. My brother and I are only 14 months apart, so we were kind of thick as thieves running around doing stuff.
We were always outside playing. We grew up on, I think it was 4 or 5 acres. So, and there were some woods down there. So we were always playing in the woods, and we had donkeys. That was a fun element. And we'd go hiking as a family. We'd also get out sailing in the San Juans. I grew up outside of Bellingham, Washington, in a town called Ferndale. Yeah, it was just a little goofball. I would get dressed up in the most ridiculous outfits and come downstairs and tell my mom, like, this is who I am today. And and she'd always take a photo. We have like this whole photo book of the different characters I'd become. I don't know. I feel like it was just a lot of joking around and laughing together. And then our power place was always getting outside and being together in nature in some way.
Do you think you as a kid would be surprised that you're a filmmaker today?
I think, gosh, I don't know. I've always been really curious about things. And that curiosity manifested in my early days is like playing with my dad's like SLR cameras, like those old film cameras. And I mean, I was just a kid. I had no idea what that thing was, but I remember just loving it. And he sort of showed me how to use it. And so I always felt drawn to visual storytelling. But I mean, when I'm like 6, like, what does that mean? I do think that kid Sarah wouldn't be surprised that I have made a career traveling and like seeing the world and sharing those stories with people that aren't going to go to those places. Like that always was something that I dreamt of, going to far off places. And sometimes I wonder if that's like being in this small rural town. I kind of felt like, I mean, this sounds so terrible in hindsight, but I had this thought as a kid that like, okay, well, if people don't really want to leave this town, I do want to leave and I want to come back and like tell them about the world. That sounds super pretentious or something, but as a kid, it sort of felt like this funny service that I wanted to do.
I mean, there's a generosity in that to show places that they might not have the opportunity to see.
Yeah, so I was like chomping at the bit. I did like this exchange program in Australia when I was 16 for a summer and came back like super pumped on that. And I'd like go off to different camps. I'd pick the ones furthest away from home and then come back. And I don't know. I think I always was like craving like seeing the outside world, but also loving where I grew up. Yeah. Young Sarah would be pretty pumped that like future Sarah figured out a way to do that.
To make it work.
Yeah.
You study broadcast journalism in college, but you ended up working at a nonprofit after school.
That's right. Yeah. I wanted to get into either radio or documentaries. It was like the only thing when I was 18 that like I should have trusted. I was actually onto something. But so I got into the broadcasting program at Gonzaga University, and it taught me how to edit, taught me how to shoot, taught me how to structure a story. It was definitely geared towards news broadcasting. So I didn't really feel like that was for me. And it still took me a while to find my way back to it. But yeah, then I moved to Portland and got into some environmental nonprofit work. And then over the course of a few years, I found my way back to filmmaking.
That was through a sailing trip, right?
So I went down to the Gulf when the oil spill happened.
Okay, I was wrong. The sailing trip comes after this.
That was just such a heartbreaking thing, and living so far away yet feeling so responsible, you know, for something like that. I really wanted to get down there and just see firsthand what was going on. And there was actually a group of us, or like 20 of us, that represented all of these different sectors in Portland. And long story short, it was being down on the Gulf and seeing this unfold where I realized, gosh, this is why I wanted to have a camera in my hands so long ago, you know, or like if I had a camera, I could be showing people the situation here instead of writing about it. Or, you know, I was down there doing other work, but that kind of opened my eyes up to the power of film. And I came back and pretty quickly just quit my job and took the leap.
For as long as I've known Sarah, and this is even prior to us dating,
this is Caitlin again,
I've always seen her as a driven and dedicated person. Ever since she made the leap into filmmaking and working for herself, I think she has had this fire inside to prove that she can do this work and be successful at it.
Yeah, I had this opportunity to get on a boat and sail across the South Atlantic studying plastic pollution in the South Atlantic Gyre. We went from Namibia to Uruguay, and that was pretty incredible. I mean, I grew up sailing, so that was such a dream come true to spend, 33 days out in the open ocean. And I was filming, so that was really exciting. And then, yeah, as an environmentalist, this felt like such hands-on, tangible work we were doing. But I hadn't filmed anything in years, so I consider that my film school. You know, I got back, tried to edit something out of it, and oh man, it like sent me into a crazy tailspin trying to make that work. And I just didn't get the like basic things you need in an edit. And sure, I could have like thrown some tech slides in. I still think like, should I revisit that hard drive and make that come to life? But it's just collecting dust right now. But I do think of it as the thing that taught me how to do this, you know, by means of what not to do.
What was missing from it?
What was missing was asking at least one person on that boat, where are we? What are we doing?
Context.
I don't know. It was such a life-changing, amazing experience for me that I, and the people that were on that boat, have become like some of the closest people in my life. And even those that I don't keep in touch with anymore, I feel like we're still a family, you know, because it was only 10 of us and on a 72-foot boat. Some of those characters were really interesting and had really cool stories. And so there is some nice like character driven stuff about why they were there and what they were hoping to accomplish and what they're passionate about. And so there are some cool elements in there, but I also think if I open that project file, I could go right back to the tailspin I was in 8 years ago. Like, what do I do with this?
So what you have to do is you guys all have to get on a boat like 25 years from now, and then you can use the archival footage to supplement the next film.
Oh, Gail. Okay. You're coming on as our producer. Let's make that happen.
The other thing that is so special about Sarah, both during this documentary process and in all her work, is the absence of I. She is completely egoless. She wants to surround herself with people that are better than her. She wants to keep learning. She isn't ever satisfied.
I think the biggest lesson I learned in that was, and it's a hard lesson, honestly, it's the hardest part I find in this work, but I have to remember that I'm not a part of the story. And here I was connecting with all these people, loving everything about the sailing portion of it. I mean, it was such an eye-opening experience from an environmental standpoint. I mean, everything about it, I was so in. And so then to try and edit this thing, I didn't take any steps to separate myself from it. And that's where I realized like you're there as a fly on the wall to document other people's experiences. That really is the hardest part of the job for me, that I like to think of myself as a personable person, and I want to engage with the people I'm with, and I want to share that experience with them. But I've had to really find a way to do that, that I still feel a part of it, yet it doesn't affect the film. So it's like, okay, camera's down, we can joke, we can laugh, but a lot of production, I mean, so much of it is me not really getting to engage with people. That was probably the biggest lesson from that boat, was that I was too wrapped up in it, and that's probably what made the edit so hard.
What kind of steps did you take going from wanting to be a documentary filmmaker, making short films for brands and nonprofits, and actually getting to do that? Like, you've worked with some big brands now, like REI, Patagonia, Osprey. Like, what did that look like for you?
When I first decided to take the leap into all of this, I mean, that was the biggest problem, is that I didn't really know what that meant or how you actually make a living out of it, you know, how you figure out the business side of it. And I will say forever, I feel so lucky in the first year that I had, that I met the people that I did and was able to work with the people that I did over the course of that first year. And I was able to actually come on as a producer and co-director on a film that was getting into a couple festivals like Mountain Film and stuff like that. So within the first year of me working as like a freelance videographer and filmmaker in the outdoor industry, I was going to like the festivals that I dreamt of going to, you know, and was able to meet tons of people. And with that, I was meeting brands. And within that first year, I met a lot of the people that I still work with today, you know, and that's been, I guess, 7 or 8 years now.
Sarah's dedication isn't just to her work. It's to the subject she is working with, to the team she brings in around her. She has formed lasting relationships with each of them. She doesn't just do the film and move on. She builds meaningful bonds that stretch beyond the duration of the project.
And for practical purposes, for anyone else looking to build her own career, These meaningful bonds are only created by putting yourself out there, by attending industry-specific events and saying yes to small projects and work that doesn't 100% look like the work that you want to be doing. It's also about asking questions when you don't know the answer.
And then it's like, okay, how do I send invoices? You know, like, how do I approach a brand to do a product video? I mean, there's certainly like that side of it that, because I was basically just asking anyone I could for help, you know, and just say, how do I do this? And can you send me a sample of this? And, you know, and I had a business partner within that first year or two that she showed me a lot of that stuff. We were also kind of figuring a lot of it out together as well. I'll never forget, like, actually doing one of those videos by myself and thinking about like how many things could go wrong the whole time. I just realized I'm all in. This is how I'm making money. This is how I'm going to live. Like I have to make this work. And I don't use the word luck often because I feel like I've worked really hard to create what I have accomplished so far in my life. But I will say that I'm grateful and lucky that in that first year, there were some people that were close to me answering all those questions and like being okay with like answering all of those questions and being really patient with me. From there until now, it's just been kind of figuring it out. I mean, each shoot's different. You're constantly learning and figuring out how you're gonna get it done.
She talks a lot about superpowers that she sees in other people and how she envies them. But I don't think she realizes this is a superpower that she has, which is that she is simply infectious. From her laugh and smile to her passions, she has this magnetism that draws people towards her. And because she has the biggest heart in the world, the outcomes are these powerful, impactful stories or lifelong friendships.
Judging by at least your Let Media website, you've made like 20 short films in the time since you started doing this work. Which ones are you most proud of? Like, are there any like particularly that you're like, this really reflects the kind of work that I want to be doing?
I mean, Afghan Cycles for sure. And we're going to be releasing that in a couple weeks here, but that's not out yet. So I guess that doesn't count in the lineup that you're talking about. I'll always have a soft spot for Catch It, because that was the first short film I did on my own from start to finish. It just sort of happened and I was there and I filmed it and made something happen. Like, it wasn't really planned, but that will always have a special spot. One, because Leia became one of my best friends through it and we're constantly thinking of things we can do together in the future. I really love A Steelhead Quest, and it's a funny length. Like, it hasn't done great in the festival circuit. I think people don't like watching it online because it's 50 minutes. Like, it's sort of a funny film, but I don't care because I love it so much and I didn't want to cut anything down and no one was forcing me to cut it down. So I was like, well, I'm making the film I want. What I love so much about that film, well, is Terry, our main character in it. And she set out to do this thing. She's got a husband who loves supporting her in that, tagging along. But at the end of the day, it was a means to get her outside, you know, prioritizing adventure in her, I mean, she's still working. So to prioritize going on an adventure every month of the year, that's hard sometimes. You know, I haven't been able to pull that off. But what she was doing by trying to catch a wild steelhead every month of the year on a fly rod, it wasn't like, I just want to do that because I want to catch fish. It was also to like show there aren't many steelhead in our rivers anymore. And I want to bring attention to that, you know, and the film touches on that. I mean, it wasn't like this heavy hitting piece, but I think that's why I love it so much, is that it's personalizing this issue. It's got those undertones. It's not like in your face doom and gloom, but I've got a handful of people I could rattle off right now that it did inspire people to get out and try fly fishing or to figure out what steelhead even are. I just love that. And so those are the kinds of stories that I'm interested in. It's like this passion driven thing, but it's really trying to like draw attention to something bigger than that.
The other thing that I really, really appreciated, totally separate from fishing, I really liked that Terry was setting these big goals, but she was totally okay with not reaching them. She was still having fun all the time. And she would say sometimes, like, I don't want to talk too much about goals or checking off lists. That's not what's important for me in this. And that's like really refreshing, where like I feel like I'm at times, I put too much value on achievements.
I'm so happy to hear you say that, Gail. I felt the same way. especially on that July fish when she didn't get it. She called me a couple days later once that production was wrapped and she said, I'm really sorry. I hope that like this still works in your film, that I didn't get it. And you know, she felt really bad. I said, Terry, this is the whole point. Like, it doesn't matter. You know, I think she felt sort of responsible, like it would make for a better film, but I actually think it not catching one made for a better film because it really showed how our Northwest rivers don't have the species in it that used to run all year round, you know. But anyways, there have been people that have watched it saying, gosh, she just doesn't really seem that upset that she didn't get it. Like, I would have been so angry, you know. And it's kind of funny to hear where I think maybe in my mind, people that have that feedback, I think maybe you need to check your perspective or, you know, here and just be out there for the experience. I mean, that's what it is with Terry. When she does catch one, obviously she's elated and happy, but she'll say like, yeah, a bad day of fishing on the river is better than like a good day not on the river. It's just being out there is what she loves, you know, and that I think that's a good lesson for sure.
I don't want to talk too long about this particular film, but the fact that she is just as happy if Jerry catches a fish and vice versa, it's just, it's so sweet and such a loving relationship. And like, it's what you want for yourself and for your partner. Like, it's so nice.
Since the day they met, they've basically been teammates, you know, to like do whatever they're doing. It's fun to see this in this next chapter of their lives. The support they have for each other is so incredible. And I just love it. Jerry's just out there so happy to tail her fish for her, you know, and like, she's also saying, I don't need your help. She was funny on production. Like, I don't want people to think that I'm just some little old lady that needs her husband to do all this stuff for her. And I was like, Terry, that is never going to come across. You are definitely, he's tagging along, you know, like this is your thing. And that's what's great. I mean, they're such a great duo and just love each other so much and support each other so much. And I learned a lot from fly fishing from them, but also just like about life and relationships and all of that.
Mm-hmm. So do you want to talk about Afghan cycles?
Sure. We'll see what happens. You might get, I could be all over the map with that one right now.
To clarify, Sarah was in the thick of wrapping Afghan cycles when we had our conversation and she wasn't all over the map. But it can be tough to talk about a project when you're still very much in it. I'm thankful she chatted with me about it after the break. This episode of She Explores is sponsored by Columbia Sportswear and their OutDry Extreme technology. OutDry Extreme is Columbia's first ever waterproof and breathable jackets and pants with a waterproof layer on the outside and fabric on the inside. With waterproof seam taping applied directly to the outside of the garment and a wicking next-to-skin membrane inside, you'll stay absolutely dry and comfortable no matter what. I love the OutDry Extreme because it considers the fact that, especially when hiking, moisture comes from the elements outside and also develops on the inside as you exert yourself on the trail. I've used the OutDry Extreme on both coasts, hiking the White Mountains of New Hampshire and camping on the Olympic Peninsula. You can see me testing the OutDry Extreme technology on the rainy Olympic Peninsula in Columbia's short film, Offline. Find it on their YouTube channel or linked in our show notes. Stay dry and comfortable no matter what. Learn more at Columbia.com. We're back. Let's learn about Sarah's upcoming feature-length documentary.
Afghan Cycles is a film that is about this young generation of women who are riding bicycles in Kabul, as well as out in the countryside of Bamiyan. And over the course of the last 5 years, we've seen really like the power that the bicycle can have for women. And that's been really eye-opening for me. But yeah, it's giving them freedom and independence, mobility. You know, they're not reliant on men to get around. They have a vehicle now on a bike. And so the film is following as these different cycling clubs are starting up. And then unfortunately, as things get more dangerous, we're seeing the effects that can have on our characters in particular, but more generally, we see that women's rights are the first to be affected when a country like Afghanistan loses its security.
She certainly didn't sign up for an easy story for her first feature-length documentary. The film and interviews are in Dari. She had to travel to Afghanistan twice during some of the more tumultuous years there. Cycling races were canceled. Girls quit the team. But there have been so many moments that she could have pulled the plug, but she hasn't once shied away from telling the story.
Sarah's been working on Afghan cycles for 5 years. That's pretty much the definition of all in. And it hasn't always been easy. Besides political turbulence and the danger that goes along with that, it's also been a huge personal investment in her career as a filmmaker. I asked her what kept her coming back to this project.
What kept me going back is wanting to tell the story correctly. I mean, things kept evolving. And every time I'd come home, I was like, okay, we've got it. And then a month later, something else would happen. Or it's hard to know exactly when to pull the plug on it. But that was definitely, yeah, I think what kept me going was just like, to do this justice, I have to include this, this, and this. And I don't have that fleshed out yet. One piece of feedback we've been getting as we've shown people, you know, and have been trying to get constructive feedback to make this film stronger. When we ask people to explain it, more often than not, we'd hear people consider it like a coming of age story, which I think is so cool. Cause that was another factor in me returning was they were so young when we started to be able to witness them growing up to be these young, strong women who are making adult decisions and, you know, figuring out, am I going to get married? Am I going to go to college? What's my career going to be? That was really cool to see too, because I did just love them and felt close to them, it was a good excuse to keep checking in on them in that way. And I think that, I hope that that comes across in the film, that we watch these young idealistic teenagers grow up to be, you know, women in their early 20s who see the world a little bit differently.
I got the chance to watch a sneak preview of the film. And one of the things that kind of struck me was one of the opening lines, I believe it was from Frozen. Is that how you pronounce her name?
Yeah, Frozen. Yeah.
Frozen. I think it was her who said that when she was a little girl, she dreamed of riding a bicycle. And I don't know that she got to start riding until she was a little older. And it's just, it was like striking for me to hear because I think it's something we take for granted here. It's like a rite of passage in the U.S. for a lot of people to, at 7 or 8, like you learn how to ride a bike.
Yeah. I think that's been the craziest part of the 5 years that we've been in production is trying to keep that in the forefront of my brain, that it's not the same at all as it is here in the States. You know, this is something they've had to really fight for. They've seeing their fathers or brothers ride bikes. I mean, the bicycles are everywhere in Afghanistan, but it's only men that are using them. So you get these young girls and women who see that and they're like, I want to do it, you know? And some are lucky enough where their dad or brother will teach them maybe in a courtyard by their house or, you know, somewhere kind of private, or they're riding down the alleyway outside of their house. But to do it publicly is something they just couldn't even fathom. And so, yeah, a lot of them really didn't get into this until much later. Although some, their families left to live in Iran or Pakistan or India or wherever when the Taliban was in power. They have memories of riding as young kids there. And then when they came back home, they didn't ride anymore. It just wasn't safe for women. But it is interesting to think about here in the States, like you said, it's a rite of passage for us now. But in the late 1800s, there are so many parallels between what's happening in Afghanistan and what happened in our own women's suffrage movement in terms of the role that the bicycle played in that. That was the thing that was giving women all of those same things we touch on in the film, which is freedom and independence. And that was really threatening. In fact, like the women that did ride bikes were considered like the whores of society. There's actually like, it's like written up, you know, because they'd need to wear pants in order to do it. And they're straddling this bike seat. I mean, it's all of the same stuff that we're hearing from people in Afghanistan that don't agree with it, you know, or the things that people will actually yell out to the girls when they're riding is almost like verbatim what was being said here during the early stages of our women's suffrage movement. We don't get into that too much in our film, but it is something that I've really been drawn to read up on and learn about and talk to the girls about, because they get really embarrassed telling us certain things. And I'll just tell them, our country's not so far removed from this. You know, we've been through the same thing, and that's why I think you're so brave. And, you know, like you're, it will hopefully change if you keep at it and get more women to ride as well.
Every moment in the production of this film is for the women she is profiling and for women in Afghanistan and beyond. She has made every decision with compassion and consideration for their story. Even as the film is nearing its premiere and the end of her work on the project, she doesn't see it that way. Just because the film is wrapped, her work with the girls and their families is never done.
Were you talking about the, it's weird to say, like, sexiness of riding a bike? Reminds me of a quote from the film, and I don't remember what the affiliation the gentleman was in the film. When he said, like, when the heart is attracted, that's when violence occurs. And I was like, ooh, that is just chilling.
That was an interesting interview. This was a mullah. It's a religious leader out in Bamiyan. And he's a typical, this felt very true of many men in that culture. I won't generalize here, but he is both good and bad. You know, that he's someone that these girls do trust from a religious standpoint. He is supportive and open to talking to them. But at the end of the day, he says, well, if they're doing it publicly, like, this is bad. You know, like they shouldn't be doing this publicly. And what it comes down to is their clothing and like their hijab and their dress. So, you know, a lot of these girls would be wearing a tunic. So that would, it covers like their crotch basically. And that was something he said in the interview. You know, I kept saying, well, what is it that is so offensive? Well, it's against our traditions, but what does that mean exactly? You know, I didn't understand, like, what is it about the tradition that makes this so offensive? And that's what it came down to, is the cycling clothes aren't tunics. So if they're wearing sports clothes, you can actually see, even with pants on, where their legs meet. And that will drive boys crazy. And that's when violence takes place. So it's like they're bringing it on themselves. And I remember asking him point blank, like, well, who's really the worst person here? Is it the girls that are riding their bikes and are wearing pants, but happen to, like, their crotch is seen? Or is it the boys that, like, want to hurt them because they can't control themselves? And he just would chalk it up to, like, oh, well, that's something that Allah will decide at the end of their days, you know? And it's just, there's so many parallels. I feel like in our country right now, and for our whole history, you know, of this, like, blaming the woman and stuff like what she's wearing and she's asking for it and stuff like that. It's blowing my mind hearing this guy talk about it. Finally, I asked, well, what do you think if they make it to the Olympics or they go to, you know, are able to compete internationally? He said, oh, well, if they can, like, bring home a gold medal, that would bring us so much pride. Like, I would be so proud of them. And I said, as long as they're not training around boys or showing themselves in public, like, they need to be on a stationary bike in their home and hopefully get to a point where they could do that. And he's like, yeah, basically. But again, I hope in the film, I don't want him to come off as, like, a bad guy. He's sort of our voice for tradition. And, like, this is really what we're getting at here. But ultimately, no one's saying this because they wouldn't say this, I don't think, to a white woman asking these questions. But from what I can gather, it isn't necessarily like the act of getting on a bicycle or straddling the bike seat or anything like that. I mean, that's plenty offensive, I suppose, just like the act of it. But really, at the end of the day, what this is that it's giving these women the freedom and independence. And they don't, again, they don't have to rely on a man. And it's just another thing that, like, kind of gives them that edge. Or, you know, like, you know, God forbid a woman can get around and go from place to place on her own terms, you know. But I really think that that's what's threatening the culture. You know, it isn't all this stuff about tradition. I just don't know if I buy it.
Yeah. Yeah. And as one of the girls said, on the bike, you can get away faster, too, if you are in trouble.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that's a big thing, too, that otherwise they're walking. They can get out of a bad situation faster. I mean, it's everything. It's like you definitely got this component of joy and, like, the feeling of the wind on your face is your, I mean, we all have that feeling when we get on a bike. And it's also just the practicality of it, of again, having this vehicle that can get you, it could be as simple as running errands more efficiently or getting to school faster, you know, all of that stuff. But it's also a safety thing that they can get out of something bad much faster than if they were on foot. And I think that's really important. And that's definitely something that we are building out in terms of, like, impact with our film. You know, once it's out, how do we use this as a way to both help the women that are in the film in some way, but also have this be an example for other countries that are considered, you know, oppressive towards women? How can we look at the bicycle as a tool in all of this and kind of add to that conversation that if women are given bikes, they're given that freedom and independence and sort of, like, self-sufficiency and security. that I think is really important.
Speaking of security, I talked with Sarah about one of her big concerns, keeping the women safe who are featured in the film. Those that have their names mentioned and faces shown have given permission. They've been in the public eye and don't see this as adding risk. If anything, they want more people to know the depth of their stories. Sarah wouldn't put the film out there if this weren't the case. I asked Sarah about the risks involved in filming in Afghanistan.
But it must have been risky filming in Afghanistan, though, right?
Oh, yeah. But, yeah, I guess so. But that feels different. I mean, I get to go home, you know. I mean, that's a funny feeling to be there getting these stories. I mean, yeah, sure, there are risks. I had a great team there, you know, our fixer. We had people there that were looking out for us and would tell us when we should, you know, feel relaxed and when we should maybe think about packing up and getting back in the car and stop filming, you know. And I would just trust them. I tried to really leave my gut out of it because my gut doesn't know that place. So I would just really trust the people that were there. And I'd look at these girls, they're getting out and riding every day. So me following along, hanging out of a car window, filming them, that seemed, I don't know, it's nothing on the scale of like what they're actually doing. It's a really strange feeling. And I'll probably be trying to wrap my mind around this till the, you know, end of my days. But it's very strange to get on a plane and leave, you know, and know that they're still up against all of this. Nothing changes. In fact, one time I was leaving and I was sitting on the airplane just on the tarmac, and I felt this weird shake going, and I started realizing that there was an earthquake happening. And we stopped, and then the plane took off, and I had to spend this whole plane ride unsure, like, how big was that? Where did it come from? You know, did something just happen to all of these close friends and like people I love? I'm like getting sort of teary-eyed thinking about it, but just spend this whole plane ride not sure of what just happened in Kabul, you know, and the effects it had. And that was the strangest feeling of Afghanistan, sort of saying, okay, you've gotten what you need. It's time for you to leave now. You don't actually know the reality here. I know it's a little dramatic, but it's a very strange feeling to drop in, witness this stuff, and then leave and come home and try and fathom that. And that was a production where it actually took me like a month or two to kind of feel like myself again. It was sort of like I call it like the post-production blues that you get home and you're kind of like reminiscing on this thing, also trying to figure out like what to do next. There's always a little bit of lag time. You're also exhausted. And it actually was like more erring on depression, because I guess it was guilt. I haven't ever used that word to describe it, but it's just a weird feeling to see all of this, try and tell someone else's story, but then go back to like the comforts of my home. And I still haven't really figured out my role in that or what I think about it.
It sounds a little bit like waking up in the morning and writing down your dream and trying to tell somebody else about it.
And then it does just feel like a dream. You know, you put me back in my home in Seattle, you know, a day or two after wrapping production in Kabul. And it's when I'm in Kabul filming, your whole reality shifts, you know. So when you ask about risks or danger, I mean, sure, it's there, but your perspective on it is totally different when you're actually in it. And you can talk with your fixer, like planning your route for the day to avoid this stuff, going to sleep at night, packing a bag that's with clothes on top of it. So if someone's pounding at my door in the middle of the night, I know my escape route out the window. I mean, it's such a weird place that those things are on your mind, but it's not taking over. I mean, but when I try to explain that to people when I get home, they're like, weren't you terrified? How did you get anything done? You're like, no, that was just the normal thing there. Like, that didn't slow me down. It doesn't put a halt onto things, but it is a weird thing to try to explain, you know? And it's also the kind of thing you can't just like, it's not like you just get home and that part of your brain's quiet. Like, it takes some time to like get back in the flow. It's like easier to land on Kabul and just be in that mode and be ready to, you just be all in. And it takes me a lot longer to like to acclimate to what I do know as my reality back home. But I had a very sheltered experience. I think that's really important. I don't want to like make it sound like it was so dangerous for me, because it wasn't. The women that are riding in Afghanistan are doing it in places that are more progressive, where their family is okay with it, you know, and where their community is supporting them. So that's in Kabul. It's in Bamiyan, which is very safe. But you think about places that are run by the Taliban, like Kandahar or something, there's like, that's a death wish for a woman to ride a bike. So I just want to make it clear, like, my experience there did feel very sheltered because I was in places that are known to be safer. And that's because that's the only place that women can actually dream of even getting on a bicycle.
So when you're talking about safety and stuff, thinking about you coming home to Seattle and coming home to your partner, like, how does she deal with that aspect of things?
Thank you for asking that. Caitlin, so we got together when I was in pre-production for this film, I should say. So I've been working on this film for the entirety of our relationship. So when we got together, she knew that this trip was coming up, like that very first production.
For us, it's been an interesting journey. When she left for a month in Afghanistan for the first time, we were just starting to get serious and falling in love. I found myself following every news outlet in Kabul, waking myself up in the middle of the night to check my phone if I had gone to bed not hearing anything from her, and it certainly brought me closer to her amazing family. We were each other's support system. I think her long trips overseas made us ask each other a lot of difficult questions early on, but what it created was a beautiful start to our relationship.
When I'm there, and keep in mind, I really haven't gone like that many times, and I do travel a lot for work, but it's pretty rare that I'm like in a dangerous situation. But the times I have been in Kabul, sure. I mean, I think it's pretty easy for your brain to go to the worst place, you know, and I think she's pretty, I've really admired how she tries not to go there, you know, and it's taken time, like over the course of the different productions I've been on, she's trained her brain to think like, okay, I haven't heard from Sarah today. I'm going to first think that her guest house internet is out, because that's probably the most likely thing, you know, instead of like she's been kidnapped. And she'll fill up her days with meeting up with people, you know, trying to stay distracted and everything. But I feel so lucky and grateful that she's equally as inspired by these women as I have been. And so she gets it, like gets why I am drawn to this and why I want to tell this story. That's not to say, I mean, she's very ready for this film to be over and to be out there to celebrate it, because it's just taken up it's consumed my whole life for 5 years, it feels like.
I won't lie, it's been a long, tough 5 years with this project being a part of our relationship from the very start. It's pretty much been her baby and my stepchild for a long time. But the fact that there will be a finished film and a premiere this month sort of feels like we're about to become empty nesters. The kid's about to graduate, and we're going to have to take up a new hobby.
I just love that she gets it, and that makes going on those productions feel a little bit better, rather than like having to convince her that this is a good idea. But I also don't want to like keep putting her through that when I think about future films and stuff like that. We'll see what's next. I don't know. But I'll also say, you know, my whole family has been really incredible. You know, I remember the first time I met up with my mom for lunch to tell her, hey, I think I'm gonna go to Kabul, Afghanistan and do this film. And she just kind of was staring back at me and didn't say anything. And I remember just saying, can you just say something, Mom? Like, I wanna make, you know, it's still a few months out. I wanna make sure that by the time I'm going, you're feeling good with this. Like, so let's talk about it. She said, oh, no, I wasn't thinking about convincing you not to go or feeling scared. I was just playing, like thinking in my head how I could contribute to your production so I could come with you. Which that was so cool. And it's a funny feeling. I don't want to put my family or Caitlin through the worry of me being gone like that again. But for what it was, everyone close to me has been so amazing through it and supportive. It's pretty incredible. I feel grateful for that.
But I guess to wrap it all up, I just want you to know three things, Sarah, when you listen to this. I love you, I'm extremely proud of you, and it's my goal this summer to reteach you what Saturdays and Sundays are for.
It sounds like Sarah's got some type 1 fun lined up, and she deserves it. Let's hope she goes all in. And when the time is right, I can't wait to see what she makes next. Learn more about Afghan Cycles and the rest of Sarah's work via her media company site, letmedia.org, and via the links in our show notes. Big thank you to Sarah Menzies for taking the time to talk with me, and Caitlin Bailey for sending the perfect voice memo to pull our conversation together. I also want to thank you for helping me reflect on the ways that I could support my partner better. Thanks to Columbia Sportswear for their support of this episode. You can see the beautiful landscape of the Olympic Peninsula in their short film, Offline. Find it on their YouTube channel or linked in our show notes. If you enjoy She Explores, you'll probably enjoy our sister podcast, Women on the Road. Hosted by Laura Hughes, it's filled with stories of the honest experiences of life on the road from the women who've lived it firsthand. And if you enjoy listening to She Explores, please take the time to review us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. It'll help other people find us. Even better, share She Explores with a friend. We're on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter, so if you share there, make sure to tag us so we'll see it. Until next week, catch up with us in our She Explores podcast Facebook group. There we talk about our recent episodes, give each other advice, and share resources and more stories about our time in the outdoors. Music is by Chris Zabriskie, Lee Rosevere, and Kay Engel, using Creative Commons Attributions License. Music is also by Kent Rockefeller. Until next week, have fun out there.